Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this special bonus edition of the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with Sup China. Sup China is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for Sup China Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree, it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Making his long-awaited return to Seneca is the man himself, that suave and debonair South African they call the Fabio of Joburg, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, who joins us from New York. Jeremy, please say hello.
Ciao, bello.
All right.
Okay, but today we're not going to be talking about my alleged beauty, but about the novel coronavirus that emerged probably in Wuhan and continues to ravage Hubei province, spreading to the rest of China and to other countries.
Today we are absolutely delighted to welcome as our guest Yanzhong Huang, who is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he directs the Global Health Governance Roundtable series. He's also a professor at Seton Hall University's School of Diplomacy and International Relations, so you can see how he would have been very much in demand during this crisis, so we're very grateful that he could make some time to talk with us. He is, of course, both a global health expert who happens also to be an expert on international relations, so it's a major element, of course, in the evolving story of the novel coronavirus. Personally, I found it very hard to get a read on so many of the central issues because you have to just claw your way through such a thicket of commentary, of rumor, of positive propagandistic spin, of unalloyed cynicism that just rejects any but the most critical reading of Beijing. So it's really great, Yanzhong, that we could have you here to help us sort through all of this. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yanzhong, let's get straight to a central question that has been occupying my mind and also causing me to get into arguments on Twitter, which is how does the fatality rate of this virus compare to SARS? And what about H1N1 in 2009, swine flu?
Well, we can certainly compare this to in terms of the virulence and in terms of the transmission. And the virulence wise, the H1N1 in 2009 really very mild. It's actually even milder than seasonal influenza. So despite those and the number of cases, number of deaths worldwide, it's actually not comparable even to the number of cases and death of the seasonal influenza. Hmm. The WHO announced it as a global pandemic, but it turned out that with all this money, the resources we spent, and I found this in hindsight, it was an overreaction. the current outbreak, the coronavirus. Well, there's still a lot we don't know, including its virulence. If you look at the government-provided data, it seems that it has a virulence constant, which seems to be a constant every day, that is 2.1%, which is certainly lower, much lower than the SARS, although higher than the H1N1 virus in 2009.
So 2.1% compared to about a 10% death rate for SARS in 2003, is that correct?
That's correct. to be accurate, is 9.6% for SARS.
Okay, 9.6% for SARS.
Yanzhong, how confident can we be that this rate is going to stay the same? Because it is still early days, isn't it?
Good question. I'm actually wondering the same thing. Because if you this is a simple math, right? You just divide the number of deaths by the confirmed cases, right? It seems that if the government data provided is that this number seems to be constant every day. Yesterday, there's the leading Chinese scientist seems to imply the denominator, that's the confirmed cases, seems to be underestimated, because a lot of people who are tested negative could still be included as confirmed cases simply because these clinical symptoms are just so similar to this that of the coronavirus.
I see. So you think that the denominator has actually been overestimated, so that the virulence might actually be higher?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see. This is just one aspect of the virus. But you should also look at the transmission also. Usually, we use the so-called R-naught, the reproductive number of the virus, to measure, right, how contagious the virus is. So for SARS, it's between 2 and 5. That means a person who is infected on average could infect 2 to 5 secondary cases. And this virus, according to the Chinese scientists, you know, the article published in New England Journal of Medicine, the R-naught is 2.2, I believe. So that seems to be not really that high as compared to SARS, although their data, their conclusion seems to be based on data, those cases that collected by January 23rd. So it is very likely also they underestimate the transmission rate of the coronavirus.
Okay, I see. So right now, this idea that it's about a 2.2 is only based on cases collected up to January 23rd, you said, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, how much comfort can we take in the fact that so far, touch wood, there have been only a handful of fatalities outside of China, and that all of the ones that we have seen are pretty directly tied to the city of Wuhan?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's now the most people would agree that the Wuhan is probably the ground zero of the virus. Although the origin of the virus, you know, this is still undetermined. You know, many people suspect this is an animal source. You know, that the bats or snakes, you know, could be the source of the problem. But there's now the social media also speculate that this could be caused by a biosafety accident that points to that Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Right. I've read that.
Yanzhong, can I ask you about that theory the virus somehow escaped from the Wuhan lab? I'm not asking you if that did happen, but is that something that could happen? Does the story pass the smell test?
Yeah, we have to hear, you know, that there's lots of rumors, actually. Some say this is a biological weapon the U.S. made against China. And then in the U.S., you have this rumor mongers saying, you know, this is a biological weapon made by China against the United States. You know, that that social media account of that the guy, I forgot his name, his account was revoked. You know, you basically have this people, advocates of conspiracy theory from both sides. But here, well, they all focus on this like a biological warfare. You know, I think this is just impossible, you know, that neither the United States or China, they may have the capability, but I don't think they have the incentive, you know, to make biological weapons or even genetic weapons. Remember when Richard Nixon decided to give up a U.S. biological weapons program, he said something that was very impressive. He said, you know, why do we need the biological weapons, you know, if we have nuclear weapons? So anybody dare use biological weapons, we're going to nuke them. So I do not think that China faces any biosecurity threat in terms of, you know, the biological weapons, you know, launched by another country. We cannot rule out this possibility of a biosafety accident, you know. So this is two different things, right? The two different things, biosecurity and biosafety. And the social media tend to, like, confuse this too. Biosafety accident is possible. We have seen that before, right? After the SARS outbreak in 2004, there are several cases of this leakage of the virus from the labs in Beijing and in Anhui.
Yeah. So biosafety would be somebody transporting an actual sample of the virus in a petri dish or something like that and having it somehow contaminate another human. And then
Yeah, if a lab worker is working on a virus, you know, and then caused the leakage, you know, that was possible. But, you know, I'm still baffled because, you know, this is like a P4 lab, right? Supposedly, you know, dealing with the most dangerous pathogens. And by calling biosafety level 4 lab, you know, that means that this pathogen are not supposed to, you know, like, leaving the lab, you know, because of the negative pressure in the facility.
Right.
You know, so, you know, there got to be some really, you know, some serious loopholes in the lab, you know, that could cause that problem.
Well, we've talked about the pathogen. Let's talk a little bit about potential cures. It appears that there are some doctors in Wuhan who are getting good results treating people with an experimental drug that was developed by Gilead Sciences. It's not yet approved by the SFDA in China. It's called remdesivir, and they're using it along with an anti-malarial drug called chloroquine, which has been on the market available for many, many decades. What are you hearing about this and other approaches, and where are we in terms of developing treatments or even vaccinations for against the coronavirus?
Yeah, I think Gilead has that that drug, antiviral drug.
Yeah.
That was used to treat Ebola patients, and it was still in this experimental stage. But now the China has that problem. In my understanding is that they offered to let China use that drug without, you know, that claiming, you know, this IP rights here. It's sort of like a gift from Gilead, you know, that it's,
right.
You know, I heard, well, there's some rumors say it was already been tested on Chinese patients and it was effective. I doubt it was going to be that speedy. But, you know, certainly I hope, you know, that it works and it could be then put on the faster track in terms of getting approved, then, you know, that mass production and distributed to the people who need them.
Hmm. Yeah, fingers crossed. Absolutely.
Yeah, and John, it's impossible to avoid the political dimensions of this epidemic. I think most people recognize that there were serious mistakes made in the early days. although it's not entirely clear whether those mistakes were purely local at the Wuhan level or at the central government level in Beijing. In your estimation, how much of a threat to the Chinese Communist Party's legitimacy are we talking about here?
Yeah, I think you are right. This, there were mistakes made. Like now, I think many people would agree, even many Chinese people, that social media were criticizing, you know, the inaction, you know, the lack of risk communication, that's potential cover up these problems. But interestingly, what we found here is like each of those, those key stakeholder who's involved in this, the response were not admitting it was their fault, you know, like the finger pointing toward each other. And I do believe that the local governments should take responsibility for not acting in a timely manner, and also for not sharing the disease-related information to the public in a timely fashion. And I also believe it is my understanding even the central health authorities, including the China CDC, they could have done a better job in terms of doing the diagnosis and reporting that information. I mean, doing the correct diagnosis and reporting to that information to the central leaders. People are unhappy with the local government. Certainly, well, that legitimacy of the local governments was tarnished. But you know, in this what we call hierarchical legitimacy, so far we haven't seen any fundamental challenge to legitimacy of the central leaders or to the entire regime. Although there are, you know, many people, even those ordinary Chinese, you know, seems to believe now that there's something deeper, you know, more fundamental measures needs to be undertaken in order to avoid this tragedy being repeated again. That is my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair.
This reminds me very much of the Sichuan earthquake, where in the first couple of weeks after the quake, journalists, both foreign and Chinese, were allowed relatively free rein to get around Sichuan and to report. But that only lasted a few weeks, and then the usual heavy-handed repression and censorship began again. On the other hand, as much as I criticize the Communist Party for their constant lying, they are faced with a situation of actually trying to manage two epidemics at the same time, one an actual pathogen, the other an epidemic of panic. You've written recently about the danger of panic in this epidemic in an excellent piece in Think Global Health. Can you talk about this problem?
Well, there are already people, yeah. There are already some people, including some legislators, calling for a permanent ban of the wild animals. My understanding is that the government may, very likely actually, they're going to impose a permanent ban, but enforcement will be a big challenge even for a country like China. You know, you have authoritarian leaders, you know, that it seems easy for them to impose their will on the state and the population. But you know, simply just like smoking, it's just that you cannot have the people change their habits overnight, you know. And that reminded me that there's the alcohol ban, right, in the U.S. 1930s, right?
Prohibition.
You know, yeah. You ban the alcohol, people start to make them at home, you know. So it will be a big challenge, you know, unless the government is willing to pursue that policy like what they did in pursuing that one child per couple policy.
In other words, with a lot of coercion.
A lot of coercion, a lot of mobilization, a lot of institutional building, and then having that norm be internalized, you know, by the Chinese people. So I think they could, invest more in terms of making that system more responding, like this web-based online reporting system. You know, this time, you know, apparently it didn't work. The recent Politburo meeting also said they're going to undertake measures to fix the loopholes, you know, in the disease prevention and control system. I expect that they're going to do something on that. I also expect them to maybe to make this coordination between different this bureaucratic actors, you know, between the functional the units and those. The territorial governments more smooth and more effective. There's some tinkering indeed will be expected.
There was a great piece in China File by Taisu Zhang, who's at Yale University, a very, very smart scholar on China. He was talking about what you had just observed about how there is not anything resembling a crisis of legitimacy at the center. In fact, there's this tendency to see the center as relatively blameless and to put sort of the blame on lower level, on local authorities. This is consistent, you know, I mean, I think everyone who understands China knows there's this phenomenon whereby there's a greater level of trust extended to Beijing than there is to local authorities. But it's kind of counterintuitive to a lot of Americans, for example, who tend to trust local government more than they do the federal government, which is
yeah, that's a very interesting comparison indeed. Think that again under this some call the hierarchical legitimacy, right? They trust the central government more than the local government. So for now. The central government could demonstrate to the people, you know, after January 20th, you know, they step in, you know, they fix this this mess, you know, created by the local governments, you know, that they were decisive, you know, they were willing to take it. Necessary steps, you know, that to fix the problem, to address the crisis, and they also they can demonstrate they can win the war, you know, that because it's acute disease outbreak, right? So it come and will go, right? No matter you take measures or not. It will go, just as a matter of time, you know. So even though President Xi, you know, tie himself to the crisis, the addressing the crisis by saying I'm in charge, that you know seems to like be a risky step, but you know I think eventually the parties will he will muddle through the crisis.
So one very big difference between this outbreak and what happened in 2002-2003 with SARS was that SARS happened at a time before smartphones, before social media. Chinese netizens still probably numbered only in the double-digit millions. I think I looked it up. It was about 85 million people in the spring of 2003 when there was that outbreak. And, of course, now there are 10 times that number of people online, and you know, well over the half of the population now is online. What kind of a role has social media played, both in keeping people informed, but also in spreading panic and spreading misinformation about the disease? Has the government been pretty careful in the way that it's calibrated using social media, either exercising censorship or utilizing social media as a tool for dissemination of information and opinion management during the crisis?
I think they are indeed trying to make the social media sort of more serving the needs of the party state. They realized that the potential threats of the social media. This is now just hundreds of millions of people using them. For a time, and I think until now, they're still sort of like in terms of information flow, you know, it's like the tap water on and off, right? So I think it's now the on stage. People started to express themselves their complaints, criticisms, you know, the sharing of these horrible stories, Wuhan, you know, that I think for this time, the government seems to be willing to tolerate those, even those criticisms on social media. But that it is also very clear, you know, they are very cautious, right? So we already seen some of those posts, you know, that was considered probably too critical or too radical, immediately removed from online.
Right. Especially just yesterday, there seems to have been a really big crackdown. Today we're recording on
I think
the 6th
for like a novel virus like this coronavirus, right? The people don't, you know, there's just so many uncertainties there, so people naturally develop this perception, you know, this is something that is truly dangerous. So when they are doing any so-called risk analysis, right, they tend to exaggerate the threat posed by an unknowing pathogen, then one, you know, that actually a more dangerous, but well-known virus, you know, like a seasonal influenza, right? That they are actually each year, hundreds of thousands of people probably died of this seasonal influenza, but nobody would consider this as real, like, a security threat, right? Or would consider, WHO would not consider that global health security challenge, you know. But for this virus, you know, because, you know, it's potentially life-threatening because of all these uncertainties, and also because they're really, you know, we don't have effective treatments to that. No vaccines, you know, no effective treatments. So it is natural that people will develop all this fear and panic about this outbreak. And that fear and panic then translated into social distancing measures, and also at the policy level, those response, you know, the country started to evacuate citizens from China, you know, tighten the entry restrictions, declaring, you know, public emergencies. You know, these actually they are. Response, in my opinion, actually should be considered like overreactions because their side effects could be more than what are caused by the virus itself. Considering that the fear could undermine the surge capacity that countries has in dealing with the virus. You know, there's a good example is the issue of the facial masks, right? So that facial mask, you said, this is the instrument to protect you, right, from getting infected. But in the meantime, it is also a symbol of feel, because you've seen all those people wearing masks. It also, you actually reinforced that the feel of the virus, and then all those you see more people would then rush to buy those the face masks. Now in China, you cannot even find the face masks. And right. the U.S. now, yeah. like in greater New York area, you know, you cannot even buy masks. Many of them were already bought by probably people who they, including American Chinese, who have actually shipped that back to China.
On the question of face masks, Yanzhong, how effective are they? From what I've been reading, they don't actually seem to be a very effective means of preventing transmission of the virus.
I'm not a medical doctor, but I was told that the N95, and also this surgical masks, you know, for ordinary people, should be helpful in reducing the chances of getting infected. Although I think the question here is that should we have like everybody wear masks? You know, like in China, they estimated that the demand for the masks is like 1.8 billion each day. But the government, these factories only can manufacture like 20 million a day. You know, so you have this huge imbalance, this gap between supply and demand, and this is already having an impact. Right? People are questioning whether, you know, that those workers, when they're returning to work next week, right, where are they going to find the masks, you know? Because if all these people get together, right, this actually only increases the chances of the spread of the virus if you don't have the masks.
Yeah, yeah. So you were talking about some of the sort of the more extreme measures that some governments have taken, border closures and such. The WHO news conference referred to the same thing. They're talking, you know, very critical about some of the measures. What were they specifically talking about? Were they talking about border closure decisions or decisions like by the American Airlines, American, Delta, and United to cancel flights to China? Were they talking about evacuations of nationals? I'm curious how you interpreted what they said at the news conference.
My understanding is that the WHO, the director general, when he was in Beijing, he said he didn't favor the approach of evacuating citizens from China. I believe that WHO is also not favoring those overreactions. Like, you know, if you only have two cases in your country, you declare a public emergency. You know, I think this is a case of overreaction. And all this actually caused actually considered the interruptions of trade and travel. You know, that actually against the Article 43 of the International Health Regulations, which is a international law that supposedly is legally binding to all the signatory nations.
The Emergency Committee announcement from the World Health Organization on January 30 was criticized by some for not only declaring an emergency later than many had wished for, but also for its praise, its rather fulsome praise of Beijing's handling of the crisis up to that date. What did you make of the WHO press conference, and what do you know about the process internally at the WHO?
Well, I think they made the right decision of declaring it a public health emergency of international concern because it is very clear, right, by last week, those two criteria they used to meet the requirements for declaring a public health emergency of international concern had been there. You know, one condition was that it posed a threat to other countries, and second, you know, that if this is to demonstrate the need, you know, for international coordination. I think both conditions obviously were met, and so WHO indeed made the right move. In terms of praising Beijing for its anti-virus efforts, I do, to be fair, I believe that the the people, the Chinese people, especially those people in Hubei and in Wuhan in particular, they deserve, credit for this sacrifice being made there. You know, this I'm not talking about also the heroism of the healthcare workers, all those things. Their sacrifice not only for potentially speedy end of the outbreak, but also I think helped us here in the U.S. Right, because if this virus can be contained there, it means we are spared here. I do think the Chinese people, the Chinese government deserves some credit for their efforts to contain the virus, although, you know, it's a different question, you know, how effective these measures are.
So, Yanzhong, it's interesting to talk to you right now because you are an expert on both international relations and on global health. So, you know, we've seen varied responses to the outbreak of the coronavirus from different governments. You know, the U.S., Australia, India, they've all evacuated citizens and diplomats. But then you've got countries like Cambodia and Kenya refusing to bring people home. Cambodia's prime minister went so far as to say that they want students to stay there to share the happiness and the pain of the Chinese people, which is interesting. It strikes me, maybe just on first blush, and maybe with the exception of Japan, that the responses of governments correspond to the state of their country's bilateral relations with China. So if they're friendly with China, the response has been not to evacuate, not to close borders. Russia may be a little different. They have closed the border. Mm-hmm. But countries that are sort of given to hostility to China or to Chinese proxies like Huawei, they're responding very harshly. Do you think there is a purely political element to this?
I think, first of all, if you compare, just to examine all these responses at the international level, you know, I think this response is, you know, that, you know, again, but it's driven by fear and this chaos caused by this, driven by this fear in responding to the outbreak, highlight the importance of the WHO to play the leadership role in coordinating effective international response. You know, yesterday WHO was calling for more money to support this fight, this war on the coronavirus. But I think it's more important for WHO to demonstrate it has the capability to coordinate, you know, this international response, which is now becoming so chaotic and itself could be actually a disaster, you know, in terms of impact on the world economy and also international relations.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yanzhong, what do you think of the predictions by Zhou Nanshan and other Chinese CDC officials in regards to the virus peaking this week, February 8th? Do you think we will see a leveling out of transmission, or will this continue to spread? And what should we expect in the coming weeks?
I certainly hope that he's right. And I think the rationale is that the draconian measures were undertaken on January 23rd, and the virus has an incubation period up to 14 days, you know, so by February 8th, you would expect that those people who are supposed to show the symptoms, you know, or should already be showing the symptoms, and they will be then found by the government and treated, right, receive treatment, you know. So you are going to see at that time, you know, at least the plateau of transmission, if not the drop of the cases, right? If you look at just the national level data, you know, we don't see that plateau of transmission. And Wuhan, certainly, while the situation is, the cases continue to increase very rapidly, and there seems to be, we haven't seen the light at the end of the tunnel at all. And in fact, probably the worst is yet to come. But if you look at the cases in other provinces, the confirmed cases continue to rise. But if you look at not the total number, but actually the confirmed cases for each day, and also the suspected cases, it seems that it is, we don't see any significant drop, but it appears to be heading in this direction of a plateau. And although that pattern remains not very clear.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Meanwhile, Yanzhou Huang, thank you so much for joining us for this fascinating discussion. I know I certainly have learned an awful lot, and I hope our listeners benefit from this as well. Let's move on now to our recommendations section. But first, let me remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and the other shows in the SubChina and Seneca network, the very best way that you can support our work is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter. It is just fantastic. So sign up and spread the word. Meanwhile, stay tuned for next week's show, where we're going to be featuring the wonderful China in Africa podcast by Eric Olander and Cobus van Staden. Another American South African collaboration, which have proven to be successful. How'd you ever hear that? Yeah. Anyway, they're going to be joining the Seneca Network. They have joined the Seneca Network recently. It has been running for as long as Seneca has, since 2010. It has long ranked among my very, very favorite shows, certainly among my very favorite China shows. I just can't tell you how thrilled I am to be welcoming them as part of our network. So I hope you listen to the show and sign up, subscribe to it, and make it a part of your regular weekly listening. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, it is our tradition that you should begin, and so start us off. What do you have for us?
I'm going to recommend three pieces from SubChina today by three talented writers. Firstly, Kenyan Students in Wuhan Plead for Evacuation by April Zhu. And then a terrific feature, Chinese Moms in America's Illicit Massage Parlors by Teng Chan. And finally, our Xinjiang columnist Darren Byler has written a very sad piece on the disappearance of Perhat Tursun, one of the Uyghur world's greatest authors.
Okay, excellent, excellent, very good. Yanzhong, you have something for us, right?
I'm going to recommend two movies. New movies. There's this movie. I think released 1995 called Outbreak, featuring Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo. About this a man-made virus. Was smuggled from Africa, to a small town in the United States, and then caused an outbreak. Then, the U.S. government has decided where, first they decide to quarantine the town, but then because the virus just spread so fast, they were considering whether to eliminate that town, using the bomb to eliminate that town. So this faced all this kind of very difficult ethical, decisions to make. So that is one. If you want to stay awake at night, I would recommend this movie called 28 Days. Was very scary.
Oh, yeah.
Although it was scientifically it seems to be not possible, but it is very scary. It talks about a very dangerous virus, that could, when you get infected, you immediately get crazy, and this is becoming all this, causing all this chaos, the breakdown of the civilization. The civilization seems to be at the the civilization is under threat because of that virus. So that is my recommendation.
Yeah, one of the great zombie apocalypse movies. Yeah, yeah, great. 28 Days Later and Outbreak. Very cheerful viewing for I've seen them both. They're really terrific movies. I really enjoyed them. Thanks, Yanzhong. My recommendation for this week is a really smart New York Times op-ed by Maria Repnikova, who's been on our program before. The piece is called The Subtle Muckrakers of the Coronavirus Epidemic, and it looks at the role that investigative journalism in China, magazines like Caixin and Caijing, and yes, they still exist, the role that they've played and how they've been given meaningful, very limited, and I'd say still very constricting space, especially in the last couple of days. We've seen a lot of these muckrakers, not the big magazines, but even smaller pieces that have been critical about the response from the Wuhan government have been taken offline. But it's a topic that Maria has written about, and she's talked about it with us on our show in February 2018. Great, great piece. Definitely check it out. Yanzhong, thank you so much again for taking the time to join us. I know
my
you
pleasure.
Must be extremely busy. Thanks also to your CFR colleagues for their help in making this happen from the
thank
studio.
Thank you. Yeah, I will let them know. I'm sure they appreciate that too.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Jeremy, man, great to talk to you as always. So nice to have you on the show after such a long hiatus.
Thanks, Kaiser.
And we promise Jeremy's going to be back like way more regularly from now on after this whole run of California shows runs, you know, where you're gonna hear his delightful, unplaceable accent more and more on this program.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the other podcasts in our expanding network. Watch this space for future announcements and new shows coming soon. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.